The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Welcome back to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. This week, I meet Jessica Brown Finley, the actress known to Downton Abbey fans as Lady Sybil, who now hangs up the corsets and furs to take on a contemporary role as a tearaway muse in a seaside town in the British film Albatross. The 55th London Film Festival is upon us, and I'll be joined by Peter Bradshaw and Zan Brooks to select the choicest screenings around town. And Zan Brooks and I will be reviewing some of the week's other big releases, including the dark Australian sex fairy tale Sleeping Beauty, Tandy Newton and Cillian Murphy in Brit thriller Retreat, and that mustachioed supersized star of the documentary world is back. We'll be reviewing Morgan Spurlock's product placement satire, The Greatest Movie Ever Sold. It's the greatest film podcast in the world, probably. It's Film Weekly. Let's have a change this week and kick off with Guardian critic at large, Zan Brooks. Zan, welcome to the pod. I'm going to be nice to you.
Yeah, I'm top of the show this week.
Yeah,
it's like a promotion of
billing.
Sorts.
Yeah, you're kind of like the fuzzy bear or Miss
am
Piggy.
Am I the warm-up man?
You might just be. Zan, what we're going to do this week is we'll look at Retreat, which stars Jamie Bell and Tandy Newton. We'll look at Greatest Movie Ever Sold, Morgan Spurlock's return. And we'll look at Sleeping Beauty as well, fresh from its kind of controversial run at Cannes. Mm. But let's start with Retreat, because it's a little British three-hander. As I said, Jamie Bell, Tandy Newton and Cillian Murphy, all locked in a cottage.
I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Private Jack Coleman. Tactical response.
Martin Kennedy.
Thank you both for taking me in.
His boat sank.
I was trying to avoid those rocks. And as I was saying to her...
Kate,
the tide's in that water. You know, I just remember the rocks and the water coming in, you know.
Are you Army, Navy?
Army. Doing a reconnaissance exercise in the area.
There's War Jamie Bell. Billy Elliot.
Billy Elliot, but as you've never seen him before, blood smeared and toting a gun and babbling about a mystery pandemic that has swamped the world everywhere, it seems, but this remote Scottish island.
Yeah, the kind of idea is kind of classic stage stuff, isn't it, really? You would expect this to be on the London stage. Does it open up from there? Does it matter if it doesn't?
I don't think it really matters. It's very much in that tradition. I've heard other reviewers compare it to Dead Calm, which is the sort of the obvious kind of reference, I suppose, a bit.
Yeah, that was about a boat and water.
Yeah,
and
well,
stuff.
It's Dead Calm in a shack on an island.
Is,
maybe a bit Polanski Knife on the Water.
Well, yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. That's the more highbrow one, isn't it?
Thank you very much.
And I guess within that, it doesn't matter that it opens up, because it's not about opening up, it's about closing down. It's about these three characters. It's about hell being, you know, three characters in a room. And within those confines, it does it very well. I'm not sure it particularly riffs on it. I don't think it particularly has anything new to say, even. But as an example of, you know, necessity being the mother of invention and making a film on a small budget, it knows exactly what it's doing and succeeds and fulfills the brief. And it's tense and involving and has enough twists and turns along the way.
That's right. There are twists and turns along the way, which sort of keep you guessing, keep you watching, because otherwise it's a bit boring. Also, the three of them are quite... They're stars in a way.
Yeah, they
I think
are.
It's quite interesting. You it helps to watch. If these were three unknowns by an unknown director, you kind of say, well, it's a little bit forced in a way, unless you've got a weirdness in it. Do you remember what's his name? The relation of Joseph Losey's grandson, Marek Losey, did The Hide a couple of years ago, which had two people watching in a bird shack on the Norfolk Moors, the Norfolk Fens. It would have been a bit like that, although they were very good. But I have seen other films where stars aren't involved. But because you've got Tandy Newton doing something you've never seen her do, doing Jamie Bell doing something you've never seen, and Cillian Murphy sort of being strangely sort of downplayed. Normally he's that kind of slightly manic and mad.
Yeah, the kind of either manic or kooky.
Yeah. As in Pluto, exactly, for Neil Jordan. But I think it was interesting to me watching these actors sort of, I suppose they take these parts because they don't often get as meaty roles as this. They've all got a lot of lines.
Well, this is the equivalent, isn't it, of doing a 16-week stint on the London stage with a real kind of meaty role, except you can probably shoot it in 2 weeks and be home and probably get paid about the same.
Yeah.
So it is a good cast. And interestingly, it was supposed to be a different cast. David Tennant was supposed to be the Jamie Bell character and then dropped out. And what's his name? Jason Isaacs was, I think, originally going to be the Cillian Murphy character.
Wow. So they've played it, they've gone younger.
They've gone younger
with
it. No
offence to Jason and David.
No, but all of that is, that's a pretty good roster of people to be able to move around and think, oh, we replace him with him.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the David Frost connection, because David Frost produced it.
Did he?
Yeah.
David Frost as in Nixon.
Sir David Frost.
Sir David Frost.
Yeah, and I guess he's got the contacts book, hasn't he?
Well, I know it started out as a project from shooting people at a script pitch. It won one of their pitches things and then got through to it. So I don't know. I mean, it was written and directed
by first-time director.
I didn't know it was David Frost at all.
I think it is. I mean,
I'm sure. Unless
it's cut this out.
Or maybe some other bloke called David Frost.
Maybe another Sir David Frost.
Yes.
The woods are full of them.
Oh, well, that's good research. So they're in this cottage and sort of things go backwards and forwards. And is there a pandemic on the outside?
Well, this is the question, isn't it? How reliable is the Jamie Bell character who shows up claiming to be a soldier from the mainland come to save them? But obviously he's not quite all there, and there's sort of dark secrets hidden.
Yeah. And I enjoyed the twists. I put twists in there because I always say if there's a twist, people kind of wait till the end. But there are several.
There are
twists.
Several.
It's about the twists and the kind of ebb and flow of power, I suppose, in that situation. That's Retreat. Zan, the greatest movie ever sold. Or to give it its full title, Pom Wonderful, the greatest movie ever sold. I noticed we had Morgan Spurlock, who's the director and star of this film, on our show when we went up to Sheffield International Documentary Festival, where that had its premiere here, because it's very much in that vein. He's the sort of Michael Moore-ish character who bumbles through his own movies trying to have experiences. He got famous, of course, from 2004, Super Size Me. Here he is trying to get sponsors for the greatest movie ever sold.
Okay, so in the film, I'll come visit you guys and pitch you about being in the film.
Have you guys ever done any product placement or anything like this?
No.
But now I'd rather know what we get. What do we get?
Sorry, yen?
You can, of course, listen to Morgan Spurlock's interview with me from our Sheffield International Documentary Show. But for now, we'll look at the actual meat of the movie, because it is about Morgan trying to generate his own product placement film, entirely made of product placement. His argument being that Hollywood films are entirely funded by product placement these days.
It's interesting you say we look at the meat of the film, because it's almost a film that has no meat to it at all.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the point. It's a film about product placement.
Isn't there there's sausage company? Or is there? No, I don't think there is any meat. You're right.
There's no meat.
Pizzas.
There's pizzas, and there's product placement, and it's advertising. It's a film about those things, and it's a film that is those things. It's a film about funding a movie purely by those things.
And him going round, getting
him going round. It's almost like a work in progress, and that is the film. And the sole aim of the film is the transparency that perhaps shines a light on this very clandestine world. I remember trying to write a feature about this a couple of years ago, just in that kind of idle way of like how much money is involved in these deals.
Let's have a look at
and
it.
making calls like BBFC and things like that, and it's totally unregulated. There is no way of auditing quite how much this is worth to Hollywood and who gets paid and what the payback is and what the deal is.
It goes on BBC films, Film 4 films, even low-budget independent films, I assume.
I'm sure, yeah. Yeah, and it's a creeping thing, I guess, in the last 20-odd years, maybe since sort of Batman, Tim Burton's Batman, which I remember was kind of marketed to the hilt.
Yeah.
Since then, it has become a creeping thing that is now everywhere.
Mm.
And you
is it bad? I couldn't get the argument here.
Yes, yeah.
I'm kind of aware that, you know, I got an iPhone. Well, actually, I haven't got BlackBerry. But, you know, we're doing this with, Sennheiser earphones. We're standing here drinking such and
when
such
When you say
coffee.
You've got BlackBerry but not an iPhone, are you saying that iPhones are shit? Are you wanting to be on
I'm
podcast
saying,
saying BlackBerry's
are
good?
The greatest personal communication devices ever.
And they work for you and therefore will work for all of our listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. But I was watching the BBC coverage of England, Scotland, Spain the other night, and there was Alec McLeish, the manager of Birmingham City, who was a Scottish player, sort of saying, oh, I could see all the Scottish fans there. They were on their iPhones looking at the results from Czechoslovakia. I was like, oh, how much did you get for that, Alex?
Well, it's very difficult to quantify, isn't it?
Yeah.
And this is all part of our lexicon now. A lot of it is just we're saying these brand names unconsciously.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hoover, you know, remember back in the day when we were kids, on Blue Peter it was always sticky back plastic. They mean sellotape.
Scotch tape.
Now they wouldn't have that kind of safeguard at all, no. I doubt.
Is that a problem? So what I can't
well,
get with
I don't know.
Is what is his point with the greatest movie?
Well, this is the, this is
wonderful
the thing.
After pomegranate juice drink, which I actually had some of at Sheffield International
documentary. Is it good?
No, it's horrible.
It's horrible.
Really
you
horrible.
Can say
I
that freely.
That. Absolutely. It's really. I wouldn't drink it again.
Well, they put up $1 million for this film.
Yeah, I like them. I like the company.
So
I like
the title
sponsors. And I like the woman who's the in charge of them.
Is it a problem? I'm sure it is a problem. But if I had a problem with this film, it's that he doesn't quite... It's more about the process. It's more about the wheeze of him going around these boardrooms and making his pitches.
Yeah. Was I supposed to think that all these advertising people are kind of, you know, I don't know, insidious or stupid in some kind of way? Because I thought they were rather smart getting involved.
They're all rather
in this
smart.
Film.
They know exactly what they're doing. Yeah. You know, they know that he's there in part to laugh at them and to shine a light on their practices, but they figure, what the hell, this is visibility, this is advertising. So he's dancing with the devil here, but you know, the devil is leading.
Wouldn't it have been better if he'd done it with politics and lobbying and kind of said, well, how much is that
even
advertising
that, not necessarily
politics?
The problem that I had with this is that two-thirds of it is basically him going around these boardrooms. So you don't have the sense of the wider picture. You don't have the rigour of the thesis. And I guess the brand that he's most selling is himself.
Yeah.
And that becomes a little bit wearing.
I know.
And maybe this is all part of the point. You know, it can be very postmodern about what this film actually is. And maybe we're all too compromised by this world to stand back from it and get a distance and be pure about it. We're all kind of steeped in the same kind of sludge. But it did make me sort of think, what is your point here?
That is the greatest movie ever sold. Is it the greatest? What did he call it? There was a bit. He said, "I want to make a docbuster."
Yeah,
that was a good term. I'd never heard before.
I don't think it's a docbuster.
It's not a docbuster, is it? Is that Sleeping Beauty? Sorry, that's not you. It was a film that we both saw in Cannes, starring Emily Browning as a naked, sort of, I suppose, I think promiscuous figure who signs up to a shady agency.
As opposed to a clothed promiscuous figure.
Well, you can do it with your clothes on. It's just not so much
it's
fun.
It's the modern world, I guess.
Here she is having an interview with Rachel Blake, a very strong presence as Madame Clara, outlining the job she's about to undertake.
You will be working with other girls, some of whom will have more responsibilities. There is room for promotion. We rely on mutual trust and discretion. And I'm obliged to tell you there are heavy penalties, very heavy penalties for any breaches of discretion. Am I clear?
Now, Emily Browning.
Emily Browning, who I first encountered, I guess, in that Lemony Snicket's film about five, 6 years ago.
Was she in that?
She was in that. She was the girl in that.
Wow. Don't they grow up fast?
They do, don't they? And we stay exactly the same, which raises all kinds of terrible quandaries. And here, she's in a very different role. She's got a kind of Tandy Newton route, really. You know, if Lemony Snicket was her Norbit, this is now her retreat.
I quite like Lemony Snicket. I suppose it's a connection, there's a fairy tale connection there, because Lemony Snicket is a fairy tale.
Yeah.
So is Sleeping Beauty, but it's not the one you know.
It's not at all. Here she plays a college student doing a series of sort of low-wage jobs and basically being a guinea pig, and then eventually a kind of sexual guinea pig. Where she starts providing a silver service, catering service to sort of rich old men, which involves the waitresses kind of walking around in the buff, handing out beluga caviar.
Yeah. Which I think is terribly unhygienic.
Terribly unhygienic, and wouldn't it just be a bit awkward as well?
Well,
wouldn't
especially
you just
at that
feel
height,
bit...
because they come serving, you're sitting down eating, and they come with their trays, and you're just at that sort of awkward height.
When you say you,
you mean
the general
I'd
you.
I put myself into the part of, not the naked lady, but of the slavering old gentleman.
Right. And from, you know, as if this is a sort of the gateway... then obviously things progress and get weirder still, and eventually she consents to being drugged and put to sleep while these same old men crawl into bed beside her.
Yeah.
Which is a bit like a kind of interactive version of that Tilda Swinton thing, the maybe. Remember that?
The installation in the Serpentine.
Yeah, where she's went to sleep in the Serpentine
and we all
walked around and crawled in.
Yeah. It is, I suppose.
It is a little bit like that, except interactive.
Yes, you can have your
Tilda draws the line.
She then wakes up and, of course, doesn't know what's happened.
Doesn't know what's happened, apart from the fact that she has not been penetrated.
Yes,
she is assured.
That's
of
the
this.
Rule, that you can't penetrate her.
Now.
People liked this at Cannes, or people were unsure about it at Cannes.
It was, I think, properly mixed, the response to this.
And yours?
I didn't like it.
Neither did I.
I thought it was interesting. It's a first-time filmmaker, Julia Lee, who's a novelist, and I think I felt that this would probably have worked better as a novel or a short story, but on the screen it feels flat. It feels, it's sort of blank and effectless.
She's got a very, very detached stare at all of this.
Which is fine. There's a lot, you know, a lot of it's shot in kind of mid shots. There's a lot of very slow fades to black. The acting is sort of deliberately withheld. Nobody's sort of saying very much.
And it's an almost airless universe. Yeah, I mean, even the sort of flat that she lives in and all of that, the lighting is very, it's almost Hanukkah-like, I suppose.
Yeah, it is.
But normally that's a good thing for me, but I wasn't quite sure what the point of this was. I think as a short story, I could have read it as metaphor. Mm. As film as metaphor, I think, is very laboured because you've got to watch 90 minutes of metaphor. I think it's a little bit boring.
Exactly. And you have to have an engagement with the people. And she doesn't want you to. Mm. She really doesn't want you to. She wants you to see this as a thesis, I guess.
What's she saying, Julia Lee?
I guess she has been described as a feminist novelist. So yeah. I guess it's a story about the sex trade and the interaction that we have. There's perhaps
is it about that, or is it about, as I suspect, men's fantasies and innocent women, or that all men are kind of, you know, vile old people?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a disgust for the old male body in this film that perhaps would have attracted more criticism had it been, you know, old female bodies shot in this way. Mm. That I think we are encouraged to find these people disgusting just by, not so much what they do, which is obviously disgusting, but just how they look.
But obviously what they do, as in join this dining club and then pay to fantasize and get not penetrate a beautiful young woman, is that it seemed a rather clunky metaphor for what we males, you know, being pointed at by the pinched Australian feminist, what we males do. And I didn't really take very kindly to that, because I don't really do that. I mean, I know Woody Allen is often accused of doing that in his films, and I like Woody Allen films, but it doesn't mean that I'm a sort of 58-year-old bloke trying to get off with Mariel Hemingway.
I think that's a valid argument. I would say that she's perhaps not saying that all men are like this. Mm. I mean, that would surely be her defence, and there's no reason why you can't make a film about this world, which I'm sure exists in one form or another.
Yeah.
But for all that, it did not engage me. It did not sort of stimulate me in the way that I think it's supposed to. It's supposed to be provocative and disturbing, and it's sort of not really. For all of the horror of it, you're not actually shaken by this.
I wasn't moved in any way, because I didn't feel any sympathy, empathy for the Emily Browning character. Well, brave as a performance.
It's a brave performance.
It is brave because she's naked most of the time. Is it really brave? I mean, it's not cold on set, is it? It's warm. Why is it brave just to get your kit off?
Well, I wouldn't do it. So because
that would
be
brave of us to watch.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, if Julia Lee was horrified by these old men, she'd just wait until the sequel.
I think the men were brave getting on, just because
they were brave, of course they were, and horrible. You know, and to take roles like this is a risk, because it's a pretty high wire act.
You need to trust your director, and it's the first time, and it showed to me.
Yeah, it did, and it just didn't work. I mean, it's interesting, and it's a film that stayed with me. The weird thing about in Cannes is that you're forced to make snap judgments immediately afterwards.
And this was a hard one to do.
This one was very difficult, and it has stayed with me, but I don't think it's a satisfying film.
That's Sleeping Beauty. Zan, very nice to speak to you this week, as usual. Will you join me for a discussion of the London Film Festival upcoming?
I would love to, Jason.
Thank you. Many young actors start their career in a humble but challenging role in a short film, so too my next guest. But in the case of Jessica Brown Findlay, her co-star was none other than Michael Fassbender in 2009's Man on a Motorcycle. Jessica had every reason then to be confident she was on the right track. It's a path which subsequently led her to becoming a household name with her role in ITV's Downton Abbey as the spirited youngest sister, Lady Sybil Crawley. This week, Jessica takes on a very different role in Albatross, the story of a teenage friendship and a grown-up romance filmed on the Isle of Man off the west coast of England. Jessica plays the feisty and sexually provocative Amelia, who, taking a job in a famous local hotel as a cleaner, finds herself entwined with a married man, Jonathan, played by Lives of Others star Sebastian Koch, and in a friendship with his sheltered daughter, played by Felicity Jones.
I came over here to go to Cambridge. saw a beautiful young actress in a touring play and whisked her away to the Cliff House just for the weekend. Wrote the book in ignorance at 22. Struck gold. And now it hangs around my neck, taunting me with its success.
Yeah, I meant the house. And, like, the actual building. Is it Victorian?
No, Edwardian, actually.
I'm joking. I'd love to know about the book.
Are you applying to university, Amelia? I'm sure Beth told you she's applying to Oxford.
I'm not actually going to uni.
Are you at the University of Life, Amelia?
Yes.
Mum says that's what Dosses say.
A scene from Albatross there, which you might be able to hear Julia Ormond making a bit of a comeback there as the mother of Felicity Jones and rather sceptical about the presence of Jessica Brown Finlay's Amelia. So when I met up with Jessica here in London, I began by asking her how she revelled in the chance of grasping at her first lead role.
It was wild that they gave me that chance. I mean, it's that sort of catch-22 of you need... To get a job, you need experience, but to get experience, you need that job. Mm. And everyone has to start somewhere. But I started with a wonderful script and a brilliant cast and a wonderful director. And I just had to do it, really. I just had to completely work my socks off and give it a go. And I thought, if I only have one chance, I really, really want to try hard and do it well. So.
How would you describe your character, Amelia?
Wow, I mean, and she has no filter system whatsoever. She thinks something, it's coming out of her mouth. That's the way it goes. And she's bold and believes she knows exactly what she's doing and that she's intelligent and everyone else is an idiot. And actually, it's sort of far more the other way around and slowly sort of ends up learning a lot of lessons, but in a situation where, you know, she's not intending to go down this journey of enlightenment. It happens as a byproduct of many other things. And
she's quite an adult figure, grown up, if you like. Mm. But of course, throughout it, we're always revealed that there's actually something really childish about her. In fact, at one point, Sebastian Koch sort of says, "Why are you behaving so much like a child?" And she sort of says, "Well, I am really one.
I am, yeah." And it's you know, she has this bravado. She's wild and crazy and sarcastic and witty, and she's not intimidated by many people. But actually, underneath, as the film develops and the further it through it goes, you realise she does have a heart of gold. It's just under a lot of stuff, and there's a reason for that. You start to understand her a little bit more, and underneath it all, she is a 17-year-old girl. She's not this robust, unbreakable person. She's a human being. And
what were you like as a 17-year-old girl?
Definitely not like Amelia. I was really quite shy. I found it very difficult to sort of interact, and I'm so incredibly self-conscious. I would never have done anything that she even would think was even boring, I probably thought.
But you're an actress now.
I know. I think it's... I sort of wish maybe at 17 someone had come along and gone, shake it off, it's okay, relax. And, you know, I never had a detention at school. I was a geek through and through, but it's all come right in the end. I'm an actress now.
were you an actress then? Were you acting in school plays and stuff?
I did, yeah. I did do school plays when I was at school. And I'm back at First Black Comprehensive School in Maidenhead. I did drama GCSE. I loved it. I adored it. It was great. And I suppose I didn't really give myself the option to sort of think about it. I think I dismissed it as, you know, another subject at school, as opposed to something I could make a living out of and go and do for a job. I mean, it's wild that anyone, that is someone's job. And I can't believe I'm lucky enough to be that one of these people.
It's like Woody Allen's dad in the film Stardust Memories, and he just looks at his son's kind of retrospective at the end, and at the end of it, like, he says, and from this he makes a living.
Exactly, they pay you to do this. There are days when you're having, like when we were working on the Isle of Man on Albatross, it was terrifying but so much fun. I just thought, I can't believe someone's employing me to be here. I would do this for free forever. This is wonderful. And
don't say that. All the actors, no. Equity will be onto us. Let us all down.
No. Yes.
When did you realize? When did you start thinking, oh, I might do this? You know, I might study this. I might get qualified in this. I might become an actress.
Yeah, I was sort of 18, 19. And I moved to London, and I just spent every single penny I had spare going to the theatre. The Royal Court was, you know, when you're younger, you go to the bigger theatres or see musicals. Well, moving to London, able to go to the smaller theatres and to see new writing as well, going and watching. What really inspired me, for example, at the Royal Court was seeing sort of actors that aren't always, you know, on your TV screens or on film, acting out things that have never been seen before. It's newly written and by people my own age. And I thought, yeah, I really want to be a part of that. I want to meet these people who do what they do and write the way that they do or direct the way they do. And I spent all my time watching film, and I just started to think, oh, I should do something about this. There's got to be a reason why. And I thought I'd give it a go, and if it worked, it worked. And if not, I'd carry on as I was before. But
how long did it take to work?
A good year of auditions, and slowly sort of getting down, you know, closer and closer. But it took me a while to sort of, I suppose, get the confidence to walk into a room in that level that you have to walk in and convince someone that you should be employed and that absolutely, you know, I will totally be able to hold my own and not let the nerves get to me and carry something like that. And that's what happened with Albatross. I fell so in love with that script and that character that I felt so stubbornly that no one else could ever play. I didn't want anyone else to have this part. So I just knew that I had to just try my hardest to convince them I was her. And I thought the only way I'd probably get it is if they thought I was exactly like her. And that's the way I played all the auditions, as if I was her. And it was only afterwards that they realised I wasn't.
You're far sweeter. What about Downton? I mean, how did you get... Because that is a... I don't know, when the first episode aired of that, I just sort of had a look and thought, well, it's never going to last. You know, it's a bit of an upstairs, downstairs kind of thing going on. Do we need another one of those? You know, a few months later, there you all are at the Emmys. Well, you weren't at the Emmys, but, you know, there everyone was at the Emmys. And now you're huge in America as well.
It's insane. It's such a... It is unexpected. It sounds so typical to say that, but no one... They're sort of old school ratings, you know, or Christmas Day ratings, those kind of things, and no one expects that. Especially a story and a bunch of characters which were unknown before, you know, it's not a remake or an adaptation. And it's a period drama, you know. It's not a gritty story of murder. No. Although who knows? No. But
he might write something in too. Who's your favourite on set? Who's the? I mean, obviously, there's the grande dame. There's Maggie Smith. Do you get to interact with her much?
We do. I think playing the three of us who play the her granddaughters, I suppose. I think we get such a wonderful opportunity to sort of chat to her because we're playing her granddaughters. There's a nice connection there because of the scenes that we have. And I think her character is very fond of the three of the girls. And I think she's probably quite glad there's just girls around because I think she likes a little gossip. and so, yeah, I mean, it's just a joy to work with someone like that. But I love every scene that I get to do with my sisters.
Jessica Brown Finley, thanks very much for coming off.
Thank you so much. Cheers. Thanks.
And Albatross is on limited release here in the UK from this Friday, October the 14th. Here at The Guardian and Observer, as any Film Weekly listener would know, we travel all around the world to cover film festivals for you, but every autumn we're rather lucky that a pretty big one turns up on our own doorstep. The London Film Festival is about to kick off, so we thought we would gather Guardian critic Peter Bradshaw and Film Weekly regular Zan Brooks, who has remained in his hot seat, to pick some of the hot tickets in this year's festival. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you very much.
Trod the red carpet to come into our Film Weekly studio. Are you looking forward to this, the 55th 5th BFI London Film Festival, proudly sponsored by American Express.
Proudly sponsored indeed by American Express, one of a long and honourable roster of sponsors for the LFF. Yeah, I always look forward to it. It's a huge amount of stuff here. Always they produce this lip-smacking, mouth-watering, telephone directory-sized catalogue for the festival, which is huge. I mean, I can't get my head around all the films they've got. Not all of them can be great, but certainly they have a huge amount of very classy films.
They do have an advantage, Zan, in that many of them have screened elsewhere at Cannes, at Venice, at Berlin, at Toronto even. So we do have some idea. Normally when we talk about up at Cannes, we've got no idea. We've got auteurs, names in front of us. Oh, we've got an Almodovar. But is it a disaster? Is it a brilliant one? Here, as Peter says, you can't get your head around how many and about, but there is some kind of idea that you can form, because some of them had. So in a way, they have got good films because they've picked the best of the rest to the fest, even though they hate me saying it that.
Yeah, well, that is what that's their USP, isn't it? It's like a greatest hits package from the festival circuit. Mm. And you say that's an advantage, but that also means that we tend to criticise it as well.
Yeah.
It's, you know, from a pure kind of news angle, it's very hard to give it the coverage, say, that we'd give Cannes or Venice, because a lot of the big films have already been reviewed by the Guardian and the Observer.
Yet, yet,
why the hell should that matter?
Yeah.
Because these films have been seen, but they've only been seen by, you know, 100-odd critics on the festival circuit. It's still a first look for the vast bulk of everybody else. And as you say, these are the best films that have done the rounds.
And so, you know, if you've read about The Artist by Michel Aznavisius and Jean Dujardin and Bernice Bejo, your first chance to see it in London before it probably goes on to, you know, be a BAFTA and Best Picture kind of thing will be at the LFF in a gala. And it is playing. And is that something you're looking forward to, Peter? Although you've seen it. I don't even know if you're looking forward to it.
I've gone beyond.
If you were someone who hadn't seen it.
You started to hate it.
No.
You got jaded. No. With it.
I'm like a kind of believer. I'm like one of the sort of Roman Catholics in Ireland when John Paul II came in 1978. I'm literally in a kind of an ecstatic
will
state.
Will you be
about
kissing
this.
The tarmac in I will front be of the Odeon Lists?
Snogging square. The tarmac. I will be Frenching the tarmac. This is The Artist by Michel Aznavisius. Is a glorious film. I think it was the best film in Cannes, actually.
I did too.
There's nothing really more to be said about The Artist. It's a pastiche of black and white classic silent movies. It is in itself black and white and silent. And that sounds kind of cheesy and Route One, but actually it's done so well and it's got such a big heart.
It's like Misnomer. I don't think it is silent. I think that the sort of
it's not entirely
the music
silent. No,
is
right.
Really good. I mean, it's not like someone's going to turn up with a sheet of music and go.
You're right.
That kind of thing.
You're right, but it's not. It has no dialogue apart from one crucially important word at the very end. It's absolutely brilliant. It's certainly one of the films that I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, I would shove anyone to go and see that. Yeah. Can they go and see these things then? I always say that the public can go and see them, but I don't
know
if they
can. Apparently not. The public gets wise, having read coverage from Cannes and Venice and Toronto. So a lot of these hot tickets sold out, you know, within hours of going on the website. I'm sure there are ways around that. I don't know. I'd hate to recommend, you know, ticket scalps and things like that. But you know, obviously The Artist is one to see if you possibly can.
The thing is, you will see it eventually, because I think it might even win Best Picture at the Oscars.
It's going to be interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
Swooningly romantic and brilliant. Everyone's in it. And you can hear Bérénice Bejo, the star of it, on our first Cannes podcast.
Does she speak?
I did ask her to do it in mime. Absurdly, that works less well on the radio than it does on screen. Yeah. The London Film Festival has got these galas in Leicester Square, which is a bit of a building site if you went through it. I went through it yesterday. I was like,
that is the big disaster, I think, for the LFF. The Leicester Square, which will be effectively showcasing London for all of these foreign visitors, is an incredible dump. I mean, it's even worse. I mean, it's never a very nice part of London,
not
to be honest
really.
With you. But now the vast area of it is basically blocked off. How on earth they're going to do red carpet events, having to inch around these kind of scaff bars, is a mystery.
You know, crowds screaming.
Yeah.
We're kicking off with 360 by Fernando Morales, which this paper, your paper, Peter, I don't mind the Observer, but your paper gave a thoroughly...
Give it a bit of an iffy review. A little bit dodgy review.
Yes.
Yes. As I say, I've got to be quite honest and say I haven't seen it.
No, no one has. They've not let anyone look at it since then.
My friend and colleague Catherine Shard, however, was pretty unimpressed. And that's the one thing I suspect was perhaps a little bit of a disappointment about this year's LFF. They wanted to get bigger and perhaps better galas for the opener, and their closer. Although I'm a big fan of The Deep Blue Sea.
Which is the closer.
I'm a big fan of that. I suspect they wanted, I think it was you telling me this, they probably wanted the Margaret Thatcher movie or something like that. The Iron Lady, yes. That was not ready yet, though.
It's still not finished. But something like that.
I suspect they might have wanted something...
A world premiere. Does a festival need something like that? I mean, we had Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris, which we're all quite fond of, opening Cannes. And I think that gave Cannes this year a good start and may do, and Venice itself opened with The Ides of March, which is coming here as well with George Clooney in tow. I think ideally it probably
does need a world premiere to open and close, and in the past that has been the case.
The Frost Nixon, for example, which I thought Peter didn't like, and they've gone on to kind of,
that's been the launch pad for Oscar success has been London. It's not the case this year. I mean, there's 16 gala screenings, and I think none of them are world premieres. Mm. But again, it comes back to the thing of that maybe matters to a couple of people in the industry and maybe a bit to us, but it doesn't matter.
There's a few I haven't seen. For example, Peter's got the programme open at what I assume will be one of his picks, which is George Clooney looking at me rather in a sort of Hawaiian shirt in the Centrepiece Gala, which is presented by the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson. This is a George Clooney film directed by Alexander Payne.
It hardly gets bigger than that in my book. George Clooney is a long-standing friend of London and a friend of the LFF, and I suspect that the choice of opening gala is shaped a little bit by talent availability. If George had been available for the opener, who knows, this might have
gone. I would have loved it if it was this.
But who knows, as I say, I don't know. This is Alexander Payne's first movie for a pretty long while,
Since Sideways.
And I'm hugely looking forward to it. It looks like another midlife crisis road movie thing of the type that Alexander Payne does so well.
Thinking about Schmidt, Sideways.
Yes, almost everything.
But Payne has a history of getting good performances out of people. People like Paul Giamatti, he got a wonderful performance out of, though he was good. Jack Nicholson, I thought, was never better than
legendarily, Jack Nicholson. Who would have thought that Jack Nicholson, that face so burnt out and strip-mined of all emotion, he actually made it kind of live again in a way. So I've got nothing but... nothing but high hopes.
So if I asked you for two picks, Peter, would that be one of them, Alexander Payne?
One of them would be one, yes. And one of them, I have to say, is a movie I haven't seen yet, but which has the most extraordinary way, snowballing interest in the press, which is Carol Morley's drama documentary Dreams of a Life.
Do you know what? You've slid tackled me from behind, a yellow card, sir. I can't wait to see that. Studs up.
It really is extraordinary. It's very rare for a film festival to have what looks like a fascinating film about its own city, this almost psychogeographical sense about how London has managed to lose one of its own, this what sounds like a heartbreaking Eleanor Rigby-style story of a woman found dead in her flat for 3 years. And she wasn't old, she wasn't a drug addict, she was 37, 38 years old. And I've read Carol Morley's essay about it in The Observer.
Yeah.
It really does sound fascinating.
In Wood Green Shopping City,
this heartbreaking and horrifying story. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I can't. That must be one of the most exciting premieres. Mm. And I hope that something good comes. There were several years ago I criticised Sandra Hebron for having very, very little in the way of British cinema or London cinema in the London Film Festival. I thought it would be a showcase. And she seems, in her 10 years, to have... you can only programme what's in front of you, of course. And I think that this year that's at a very strong strand. I hate to bang on about British cinema, but because it's often disappointing or it seems like you're cheering your own backyard. But I do think that it behooves the London Film Festival
right
to do that.
British cinema's on a roll.
Well, exactly.
Right about now.
Yeah.
British cinema's sort of never been better.
No, I didn't know we were the third... I only read this the other day. We're the third largest box office region in the world.
Is that true?
Well, I read it and I couldn't believe it. I thought France was higher and I'd have thought, other places were higher. But for Hollywood, anyway, it may be the case. But it's certainly got a good mix this year of new British cinema, which I haven't seen. Is there anything that you're picking out, Zan, that is from that region, or are you sticking to the world?
Well, no, I mean, in terms of the British cinema, the Premier League, I guess, of British films that we've seen elsewhere, that we need to talk about Kevin, which it goes on general release next week, but you get the chance to see it first, which I would heartily recommend. Lynn Ramsey's...
Would you wait till it comes out?
No, I think if you see it now, see it now.
Yeah,
why
see
not?
It when you can. See
you
it
know,
again.
You might be dead next week. Kevin might get you.
No spoilers.
Yeah. And Shame by Steve McQueen, which was at Venice, which was possibly the best film that I saw at Venice.
I think you're... Well, I don't know everything you saw, but I think you're right, because it was the best film I saw.
I thought it was excellent. But I liked Alps as well at Venice, which I know you hated.
I did. That's also here.
Which is also here. Yorgos Lanthimos' film from Greece. Very strange, dark film, but sort of, I thought, brilliant.
This LFF, I like to stroll around like a boulevardier in Leicester Square. least of boulevards.
What's that like?
Well, you know, you can do all right if you can get it.
Yeah.
I like to stroll around the festival, and I know a lot of film critics have sat through the press screenings, which they have at the NFT all through the last week. So people just sat there kind of going, seeing all these films. I think I prefer to go to the festival and feel it and kind of get the vibe. It is a different feeling, a festival film here, than going to see one normally. Not that either of us probably do that at all.
I don't. Well, there are two things the LFF always does in a rather brilliant way. I wish I could catch more of it, is that it has a special experimenter section, which is kind of brilliant. I mean, no other, I don't know any other film festival that does it.
No.
And it showcases these weird and wonderful and fascinating kind of real avant-garde things.
And that's the BFI. Do you think that's the BFI's
privilege?
Sort
of. It's sort of, but it's certainly interesting. And a lot of these filmmakers get a real boost from the London Film Festival. And it's also famously a very Francophile festival. It has a separate section for French
films. The French
film.
Get...
No separate section for Germans or Spanish or anything like that. But the French, there's an old-fashioned, as it were, roll-neck jumper-wearing, gitane-smoking feel that the French still...
Cannes doesn't return the favour, though, does it?
No. Oh,
they
no.
snub us.
No, they do. Just... I'm sorry to say they do. Well,
the other section as well is the sort of experimental, which is sort of interesting, and you probably would be able to get a ticket for, is the archive section, which is always worth... checking out. And this year we've got Elia Kazan's America there, which I've never seen.
Well, you know, I've seen the Marty Scorsese documentary about Elia Kazan.
Exactly.
It has a bit of it in there.
And also Nicholas Ray's We Can't Go Home Again, which was made when Nicholas Ray was totally down on his luck in the 70s with sort of students in California. This apparently is kind of weird avant-garde folly or masterpiece, I guess, depending on your take on it. And also Les Enfants du Paradis, Marcel Carné's sort of film made under the radar during the occupation.
Lovingly restored.
Yeah.
It is long. It showed on an afternoon in Cannes where I was supposed to be recording Film Weekly and doing stuff, so I couldn't go and see it. I'm so excited to see that. It's going to look absolutely beautiful. In a way, those the interesting to compare that to The Artist, two black and white French films, kind of classics of the silent. One actually kind of has Arletty doing his mime in there, and one ode to that. And then you've got this, you know, The Artist, which wouldn't exist without Les Enfants du Paradis in some way. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to Kore-eda's new film, I Wish, the Japanese filmmaker who made
film.
Nobody Knows and still working. Have you seen it?
I have indeed.
How comes you've seen it? Why have you
it's
seen
it? It's in San Sebastian. And a terrific film. I mean, it's a real, as it were, lump in the throat family movie.
Yeah,
but
I love it.
Made
that.
Sublimely with the performances, just miraculously natural performances from the two kids.
Yeah, I mean, he got his 14-year-old actor won the Best Actor at Cannes for the film Nobody Knows.
Yes,
which is extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. It really does live with you. It's a beautiful film.
He seems to have developed into sort of a modern day Ozu.
Sort of Ozu, yeah, with his new interest in sort of still walking and the family movie genre. It's sort of unfashionable, or only semi-fashionable in Japan, but he has sort of single-handedly revived it. I think I should, at the risk of sounding kind of earnest, it's also quite important, I think, the LFF has given space to the two of cinema's genuine prisoners of conscience, which is the two Iranian filmmakers, Jafar Panahi and Mohammad Rasoulof. And I know Rasoulof's film Goodbye, which is at the LFF, this agonising, lacerating and not very funny or jolly film, really attacking Iran. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. These two filmmakers who are, I think, genuine prisoners. They're almost sort of Solzhenitsyn figures. Well, not Solzhenitsyn, but they are genuine prisoners of conscience, and that they are almost alone in the cinema world. They are taking a risk in making their films in a way that nowhere else does. And I find it extraordinary that they are, that their achievements in continuing to work with extraordinary courage, almost suicidal courage, isn't noticed more than it is.
Sandra Hebron, this is her last and 10th year at the helm as artistic director. Has she changed the LFF?
Yes, I mean, Sandra Hebron has worked very well with her management board. If you want to see how it doesn't work, you look, I'm afraid to say, at Edinburgh. And that's how it doesn't work. That's how the artistic director, his or her relationship breaks down with the board of management. They lose sponsorship or become exposed to one particular sponsor, and then it really can lose its heft.
I think Edinburgh staying in June, it has got a new artistic sponsor, new artistic director this year, so it will happen again. I was worried at the LFF's rise that under Sandra Hebron, I think, which has, she's mediatised it a bit, I think it's got a bit more important in Oscar race, so that's helped the studios and all of that rather smartly. For that it waxes, Edinburgh has waned.
I think that's very definitely true. I mean, I think, you know, 10 years ago,
Edinburgh was a very close second. It was running very, very close behind, and almost had more kind of kudos, kind of cult kudos than London did now. Edinburgh, it's been a spectacular meltdown there. London Film Festival, I think under Hebron, hasn't radically changed, but it's consolidated its position. It's been a very strong decade.
Yes, and well done, Sandra Hebron. We thank you for your work. And we welcome Claire Stewart from Australia, who not only will be programming the LFF next year, but also be in charge of programming at the South Bank. They've moulded two together. And I don't sort of blame Sandra for ducking out of that from Future, because it's not going to get easier to do these festivals. But for now, the 55th edition is underway. And maybe you'll spot film critics in Leicester Square, or maybe you won't. Will I see you, Peter?
You usually do, yeah.
Yes. We'll be disguised as builders.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. We'll have our high-vis tabards on, obviously.
We'll be whistling at Rachel Weisz. Wait, love, up here. Like paparazzo. Peter, Zan, thank you very much for guiding us through the LFO. And for more information on the London Film Festival, just skip over to their website. That's bfi.org.uk/LFF. And that's all for this week. The music we've been featuring on the show is Andre Previn's fine recording of Samuel Barber's Violin Concerto. It's the opening music to Terence Davis's The Deep Blue Sea, which is, of course, the closing film at this year's London Film Festival. And we'll, of course, be bringing you all the news, reviews and personalities of the LFF. But even Film Weekly can't be everywhere. We want to hear from you, what you've spotted at the LFF, what you've liked, what you've loathed. Do let us know. Film Weekly fans on Facebook, that's us. We'd love to hear your reviews and your views about what's been on at the LFF. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my Film Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, have a great week at the cinema, wherever you go to see your films. Until next week, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.